morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. For once, we're not going to talk with Dr. Bob Pondillo of the Electronic Media Communication Department about his glorious independent films, although we'll be happy to have him back in the future to do so. We're going to talk about a book he has written called America's First Network TV Censor, the work of NBC's Stockton Helfrich, and it's from Southern Illinois University Press.
Right, right.
And
it's, just for those not to correct, but it's Helfrich.
Helfrich
is how it's pronounced.
Ah, okay. You want the hard CH on the end, right?
No, that's the way he did it. Anyway.
Is it German?
Yeah. I guess, yeah,
again?
German.
Okay. Stockton Helfrich.
Or who, Dutch, I think. German-Dutch or something like that.
He worked for NBC. He was the, well, the legal guy, the legal guys were in what they called standards and practices.
Right.
And Stockton Helfrich was in what they called CA. Now, what did CA stand for?
Continuity Acceptance is what it's, or C-A-R-T. Continuity Acceptance Radio and Television, or the CART reports. And that's what Stockton Helfrich wrote for, gosh, 11, 12 years, something like that, from 47 or so to about 1960.
But the bottom line was he was the censor.
Yeah, he was the censor.
He was the gatekeeper, the arbiter of what was and was not good taste.
And maybe we should make it clear, you know, censorship in the strictest sense of the word is the state clamping down on free speech, essentially. The state wasn't involved in this. This was the National Broadcasting Company, right?
He was an employee
of the National Broadcasting Company. Exactly. So he was, this is about self-censorship and about how the industry was to have policed itself back in the late 1940s, early 50s and stuff. But still, you know, it's censorship.
Yeah. Well, great
Make
deal,
no mistake about that.
A great deal of TV and radio were live. In the so-called golden age of television, and you did not have a six-second delay, which would prevent something like the F word from going out over the airwaves, although it never would have during those uptight Cold War days. Talk
Very
a little
true.
Bit about the era of American history we're talking about, and general tenseness and paranoia that pervaded this whole period.
Well, there was that. A lot of people think that, you know, well, the 1950s and Cold War America, or at least 1950s America, post-war America, was, you know, the time of Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet and those kind of things. And there was certainly that. But there was really an underlying sense of, well, based on the research I've done anyway, a sense of doom, a sense of an anxiety that the Russians are coming. You know, we won the war, and now the Russians have the bomb. What's going on? And so many people, I mean, if you look back at Look magazine and Time magazine and New York Times and what have you, all, you know, publications of record, you'll find people saying they expect World War III to begin at any moment, you know. And so, there was that anxiety, and there was all sorts of other anxiety as well. I mean, we're coming out of you know, a depression and then a world war. And now, after years and years and years, 4 years or so of savings, because, you know, the industry, you know, the American industry was sort of everything was turned toward the war effort. Well, now everything is being retooled to make consumer products. And since there were no consumer products and there were all sorts of restrictions on how you could purchase things in nylons and rubber and all these things, there was pent up savings. A lot of people had lots and lots of savings, actually. And so when all the consumer products came back, including television, man, there was a huge boom. Everybody was buying television. I mean, really, it was it was incredible how many sets were flying out of you know, stores at, I don't know, one every 5 seconds or something like that. I mean, it's just incredible how many people were buying sets.
Milton Berle, who was on NBC in the Texaco Star Theater, sold a lot of those sets. I mean, it's hard to imagine for people today with cable TVs and everything, but that show was appointment television. I mean, he was on in the bars, he was on in the homes, he was on in the windows of the appliance stores.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that, Howdy Doody.
It's like the whole world stopped.
Yeah, and Bishop Sheen was also on. In fact, competed with with
Milton Berle,
Uncle Milty.
Beat him in the ratings sometimes.
Yeah, many times, absolutely. But the point I was trying to make is that, so all these televisions were being sold, and televisions were everywhere, and it was the most adopted form of appliance ever. I mean, it took radio almost 30 years to have the type of penetration that television did in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so there was a confluence of events that made that happen, which means the money, people had the money to do it, there was the product there to buy it, and interest in doing it. So television was everywhere, and you know what else was everywhere?
What?
Communists.
Oh.
Or at least that was the thought. Communists
under every
were around
bed.
Every corner, under every bed, exactly. So television was looked upon initially, and even maybe to this day, a little suspect, you know, what is this thing that, is it watching me or am I watching it?
A little Orwellian thing going on there,
sure. So there was a little bit of anxiety because of that. But there was other anxiety as well during the 1950s, including sex, mm-hmm. including language, including racism.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that. And all those things are the things that Helfrich had to deal with. So this is a story really about post-war America, 1950s America. That's the backdrop.
Right.
And the actors are Stockton Helfrich and all the other things he had to deal with on television at the time.
Now, how did this guy get his job? I imagine if you're growing up in the 30s and 40s and somebody says to you as a little boy, what do you want to be when you grow up? You don't say, I want to be a censor so that I can make sure that people are not offended.
No, I don't think he wanted to grow up to be a censor. He grew up in a family with his brothers were very athletic. He wasn't. His wife, earlier, he had two wives. His first wife, whom I never did have a chance to talk to, was very, very careful about talking to me. Anyway, she said in an interview, a taped interview earlier, that I've never met her, but she said Stockton had these lovely long fingers and could write so well and is a poet and that type of stuff. So he fancied himself more as a writer than anything else. And even don't let the Stockton Helfrich, don't let that sort of snooty name, you know, fool you. He was a upper middle class, or at least he started out as an upper middle class kind of guy. And his father took a hit in the stock market. So slowly, he was, you know, the houses got smaller and smaller and smaller. And his father then died of the problems, you know, that he incurred through the stock market, a high blood pressure problem and stuff. Anyway, so Stockton was a bookish kind of kid, mm-hmm. Writer type and reader, unlike his brothers, and went on to Penn State University and sort of put himself through Penn State University. So he wasn't a, you know, rich kind of guy, that snooty rich kind of person or a blue nose in any way. And one thing led to another, and upon his graduation, he got a job as an NBC censor, NBC page at NBC Radio. So he's at radio. And this was in 1939, so the stars aligned, and Stockton Helfrich got the job at the exact time that NBC, as we know it, in Rockefeller Plaza, opened.
Mm-hmm.
So Rockefeller Plaza was still, you know, there was still construction going on there and what have you. Radio City was still being built and all that. Mm-hmm. But that's where he got his first gig as a page at NBC.
Now, when they hired him to be the censor, and you talk about it in the book, one of the big obsessions and fears was about the cleavage of female entertainers.
That's true.
Who
over the edge.
Appeared on a television on variety shows and whatnot. I mean, they never had to worry about that with Dinah Shore. She always covered up. But there were certain buxom blondes of the era, like Jane Mansfield. I remember her standing next to Mickey Rooney at an awards ceremony, and he looked over at her and said, "Who wants to be tall?"
Yeah, that's cool. That's good.
Yeah.
But,
and then there was
that.
This woman named Dagmar.
Oh,
who
Dagmar,
was,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, who was huge, well, in so many ways, back in the 1950s, late 40s, early 50s on a show that eventually became The Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
Toast of the Town is what it was.
Dick
called.
Cavett tells the story about how he used to be a writer for Jack Parr, and he kept on writing. Jane Mansfield was going to be a guest on the show, and he kept on writing intros. And Jack didn't like any of the intros that Dick wrote for him. So finally, he just, in a fit of exasperation, Dick just gave up and said, wrote the intros. Ladies and gentlemen, here they are, Jane Mansfield.
See, and we kind of laugh at that now. And they, of course, laughed probably even harder at that then.
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of anxiety over human, female human breasts. I mean, that's just the way it was. Why that is, I don't know. I mean, breasts throughout history have been sort of sexualized and, you know, what else? Worshipped in mm-hmm. you know, sometimes.
Well, how did Helfrich deal with that?
Well, one of the things that Helfrich did was, because as you mentioned earlier, there was no videotape yet in the early 1950s. Tape, I mean, they were experimenting with it, and tape was around, of course, audio tape, and wire recording was around. But videotape didn't really hit. It came in around 54, but really didn't stick until about 56. So it took a while. So in the early 50s, when they're having these shows with these women with the low-cut dresses, not that low-cut, by the way,
yeah.
things that, you know, like high school kids going to prom look this way now, you know.
Right.
But there were literally other censors standing by with tulle, a little kind of fabric, that would sit in the control room, and if they would see any kind, and they called it the cleavage control, or the cleavage patrol, the cleavage patrol, and they would sit there, and if they saw anything during a commercial break, they'd rush out and put a little flower, you know, like a mm-hmm. rose or something, or put a piece of tulle in front of their breasts, and so you couldn't, you know, you couldn't see the cleavage.
Because right. there was no CGI. You had to do this with literal fabric. There was no computer graphics right. that you could, you know.
And if they didn't do that, they would get all sorts of letters and phone calls and stuff saying, how dare you? It's filth. They would call this filth. Mm. They'd call a lot of things filth back then, including brushing your teeth on television. You're not supposed to brush your teeth.
Right.
Or show a toilet, for God's sake. Show a toilet. That would send people over the edge on that.
Was Helfrich responsible for what happened to Jack Parr when he told the infamous, yet by today's standards, quite innocent WC joke?
The water closet joke, yeah. He was there. This was at the almost near the end of his tenure at NBC in 1960. And the story is Jack Parr tells this joke a person confuses WC water closet
with Wayside Chapel. Yeah.
And hilarity ensues, of
right.
course, right? So that joke is told innocently by Jack Parr, and he goes home, and, you know, because they tape at 5 o'clock in the afternoon or something, he goes home. 11:30 at night, the show comes on, and not Helfrich, but another person in legal decided this could not go on, so they chopped the entire, I think it was 6 minutes or 4 minutes.
Oh, yeah, back then they told long stories. They didn't just do one-liners and, you know, kaboom.
Right.
You could tell long stories, like Danny Thomas and Myron Cohen, it go on forever, and you'd have laughs throughout
the
course of this.
Sure, half the fun is getting there.
Right. Right.
Sometimes at the end, the punchline isn't that funny, but it was funny getting there. So he tells this joke, and they chopped the whole thing out and put on an NBC news bulletin or something. And it just sent Jack Parr over the edge. He was so angry about this that he walked out. He quit. He went on television the next night. And said,
quit on the air.
Quit on the air, leaving a stool and a microphone sitting there. And what are they going to do now, you know?
It stunned Hugh Downs, who was his announcer, had to fill in and pick up and go on.
Right.
But
yes, so Stockton was involved, only to the extent of being surprised and wondering what happened and why wasn't he informed. And he was chopped out of the loop on that one.
I
think he would have let that go.
Did they keep him out of the loop because they figured he would have let it go?
That's a good question. I don't know. I hadn't even thought about that. I think he was seen as a company guy, believe it or not. And there's one thing I think, as you read the book, you learned, and those who read it will learn, that Stockton Helfrich, you know, was a very sensitive guy, but when he joined NBC in the late 1930s, he was a communist.
Mm-hmm.
He was a pinko. He literally wasn't a red. He was a pinko. He was a part of the Popular Front, as they called it back then. And a lot of sensitive young men and women just out of college, or just people that were, you know, had a great heart for the poor and what have you, got involved in the Communist Party at that time.
This
too.
Is before it became exposed about all of Stalin's dirty deeds.
Right, exactly.
Which caused a lot of people to turn off to the Communist
right.
Party.
And you have to also remember, too, in fact, a lot of scholars look at this time and say, well, the communists, to these guys, to the Stockton Helfrichs and those of the world, those Steinbeckian kind of people of the world, you know, the Grapes of Wrath kind of people, were, well, that's exactly it. They held high the working man and the poor and what have you. And they noticed that the government at that time, the welfare state wasn't so entrenched as it is now. Mm-hmm. There was no relief. There was nothing. And so there were all these poor people, you know, with their vacant eyes sitting there, you know, in the cold and what have you.
And they saw Hoover as, you know, Marie Antoinette in a suit saying, let them eat cake.
Well, yeah.
Basically.
And so Stockton and others saw this and said, we've got to do something about it. And that, so the Communist Party in that way, at that time anyway, was more of a, a Lions Club or something. I mean, they were doing really food drives and can drives and stuff to make money to help people, not necessarily a political slant. Although, you know, he did have some liberal leanings. There's no doubt about that. He was a progressive in the best sense of the word.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, how did he approach other questions of language? On radio, I listen to a lot of old classic radio, and Hope and Crosby especially, to a lesser degree, Jack Benny, and to a greater degree, Tallulah Bankhead, on their shows, could get away, and Tallulah was on NBC,
right.
Could get away with a lot of double entendre that seems pretty obvious to us now. But when it came to TV, how far could you go with that sort of thing under Helfrich's purview?
Language was always a concern, always a frightening for some reason, especially during times when, the NBC, when the censors themselves were concerned about language because there was no way to stop it. Like you mentioned, the six-second delay, you couldn't do that. And it wasn't on tape, so you couldn't cut it out or bleep it.
Mm-hmm.
And they did worry about comics. And there were like a Milton Berle or a Jack Carter, a comic out of Chicago, who, would occasionally do little lines that annoyed censors and what have you.
These guys were old vaudevillians,
exactly.
And sometimes worked burlesque houses, and sometimes, you know, things got a little bawdy in those clubs.
And they did. And some of these shows, too, were on late in the evening. After 9:30, NBC thought was, you know, it was very interesting how they imagined viewers of television back then as well.
They were day-parted.
Oh, absolutely. They said when 9 o'clock came, the children went to bed.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it was. And they had a whole world, a whole world view of who watches television when. Women watch here, mm-hmm. men watch here, men control here, women control there. And then, of course, the children go to bed at 9 o'clock. And so it's okay to put on Lights Out or any other, you know, mm-hmm. scary program or something at that time. And if Stockton Helfrich would receive postcards or letters from people saying, how could you put that program on at 9 o'clock? He would then, chide them, or he would wiggle his finger at them, you know, shake his finger and say, now you have to be better parents than that. You know, you must not let your children watch these shows. So, and he did a lot of that in his cart reports, if you read them.
So yeah. you could get away with saying damn or hell, but what else?
Oh, rarely though.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to watch. In fact, that's something that's kind of interesting. There were great television writers back then. Rod Serling, Horton Foote, Gore Vidal, mm-hmm. name some more. Those guys, those big names.
Patty Chayefsky,
okay. Great television writers back in the 1950s. And they were considered writing kitchen dramas is what they were called. Little stories about big issues, big themes, right?
Right.
And these guys, Chayefsky, Foote, Rod Serling, and what have you, Gore Vidal, these are the guys that can get away with saying hell or damn a couple of times in their scripts, right? However, the thousands of television writers, or hundreds at least, of television writers at the time who were not as well known mm-hmm. would get their scripts just ripped apart. I mean, they would just be chopped to pieces in terms of taking out language or violent images and what have you, because the script would call for a violent image of some kind, and that would be taken out as well. So I think there was a pecking order in terms of the television writer and what words got to be on the air as well.
How much violence did they allow for? Gunsmoke was the on CBS. It was not on NBC, so it didn't come under Helfrich's purview. It was a mm-hmm. Western, and it ran for 20 years,
right.
20 seasons. The bad guy always got caught, but, Marshall Dillon shot a lot of people.
Well, that's true, and there was a lot of that. There were westerns were everywhere.
There were a lot of westerns on NBC, Bonanza.
Sure, the two most pop, well, the most popular genre on television from about 49 to about 59, mm-hmm. probably about 10 years, was the western, you know, drama,
right.
Or the western. And so there was, and the other thing was quiz shows. Those are the two things that were huge.
Right.
In fact, my students don't realize this, but the number one thing that kept NBC on the air early on, like between 48 and about 52, was wrestling.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wrestling was huge. Everybody watched wrestling, even though, and so, and that's another reason why television had a sort of barroom pedigree kind of thing. You know, people looked at television at that time, at least the literati looked at it and say, ooh, television with their, you know, sweaty wrestling
and
boys
roller and, derby.
Yeah,
and,
yes, of course. Very bad. And then eventually things changed.
Although and the Friday night fights.
Yeah, and the fights. And they did, later on there was like Your Show of Shows was on television.
Oh,
at
yeah,
that time.
Sid Caesar,
Imogene Coca. In the middle, they did something called Operation Frontal Lobes back at the time. I don't know if you read about that.
Yes, I did. It was started by Sigourney Weaver's father, Pat Weaver, who is one of the great all-time executives of television history at NBC.
Right. He was the one that developed The Tonight Show, The Today Show,
mm-hmm.
and I think The Home Show, which didn't stay on. But those two, Today and Tonight, are huge. And it's hard for us to remember that people did not watch television in the morning.
Yeah.
They got up and they read the paper or they listened to radio or they had a cup of coffee or whatever they did, but they didn't watch television. Mm-hmm. So he, Pat Weaver, was trying to push people to watch television in the evening and television early in the morning.
And he even got a very literate guy, Dave Garraway, to be your morning master for the Today Show.
That's
at the time. This was not some, you know, bubble-headed knucklehead.
Although he did have a monkey.
Wow.
Dave Garraway.
J. Fred Muggs,
the monkey on there.
Yeah,
so
he was the knucklehead.
But anyway, so it was... It was this fella, Pat Weaver, who came up with this notion of the Operation Frontal Lobes, where in the middle of a comedy show, right, like Your Show of Shows, he would put on 5 minutes of an opera or like 5 minutes of a symphony orchestra playing a beautiful symphonic sound because he wanted to bring culture to everybody rather than just this slapstick kind of comedy. It was really out of place, but it was a funny idea when you think back on it, because among the things that were happening was television was being poked by the richer and literati and what have you.
And by school teachers.
And by school teachers saying, come on, you know.
They criticized Dizzy Dean for not using proper grammar when he called the game of the week on the baseball.
But you were asking about the violence.
Yeah.
And the problem that Stockton Helfrich had, he didn't have problems with violence because he understood, being an English major, you know, that you have to have conflict in a story, and usually conflict revolves around some kind of problem or butting heads or violence or something.
You can't do an episodic drama about a war without shooting people.
Yeah. So, but his concern was how the violence was, where the violence was committed. So he didn't want so many people getting shot in bars. That's the thing that Helfrich was upset about. So if you're going to get shot, get shot outside the bar or near the library, is what he said, or someplace else. So and violence back then, remember, was bang, and then the person would grab their chests and fall over.
I mean, and not bleed.
And there would be no blood. You wouldn't see anything. You'd just see him fall over.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like almost funny when you think, because we look at things these days through presentist eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We are so conditioned to the violence we see on television and the gallons of blood in Quentin Tarantino movies and stuff that we don't even see it anymore, you know.
Yeah.
But to see, if you watch these old television shows like on TV Land or something, you'll see...
YouTube,
yeah, you'll see these guys grabbing themselves and falling over and really dying slowly, too.
Well, you don't see, or at least not even on the old soap operas that I've seen, domestic violence. You don't see a husband giving the back of his hand to his wife when he gets hacked off at her. Mm-hmm. And you don't even hear rape being referred to, let alone being depicted or being part of a plot line or story arc.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that Helfrich was very sensitive to. There was, and I think it was reflecting the time more than anything else. He never showed a woman with a sex drive. Mm-hmm. He would chop that out if that was shown. So it was always the man had to be the aggressor.
So you couldn't show an actress being a prostitute or a woman of easy virtue, as they used to say?
Well, you know, you could show them, but something bad's going to happen to them.
Right.
That's for sure. I mean, you have to, anything considered bad or distasteful or not.
The hooker had to get it in the end.
Yeah. You know, or
so to speak.
Or have a heart of gold or something, so to speak. Exactly. But so there was that. And then there was this problem with the breasts, as we talked about, mm-hmm. and language and the worry about toilets and toiletries and, mm-hmm. and all those things that like, you couldn't show Zit Cream on television. You couldn't show, like, Clearasil.
Which is, Dick Clark never would have had a career.
Yeah.
You know?
Because people actually said, oh, that filth. How dare you? In fact, here's something. I know I'm skipping around, but mm-hmm. These ideas are coming to me as I talk about it. You could only show a cow on television, an animated cow, wearing a skirt.
A little tutu, yeah.
You couldn't show a cow with the udders. You mm-hmm. had to have the cow wear a skirt. Now, that gives you how far people have to go because of the milk-secreting glands and whatever images or associations people would have with cows. I mean, it's like, what?
Yeah.
I know, but that shows you where
the farmer has his hands on the cow's udder every day. That's before the milking machine. That's how the milk gets into the pail.
And I don't even know. They would probably not show that. They would probably just show the guy with his head near the cow, and you'd hear
sitting
the sound,
the
perhaps,
uh-huh.
but you wouldn't see it. Yeah.
Right. You know? How did Helfrich's attitudes and the way he implemented them at NBC compare to what was going on at the other two networks, or other three, if you count DuMont?
Yeah. Well, I don't, this is a very tight and focused study on just mm-hmm. NBC and Helfrich. And the reason is because he left so much information. I mean, he really gave us a window mm-hmm. into not only television, but 1950 itself, the 1950s themselves.
Well, would you consider him a progressive thinker for the time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Way ahead of everybody in terms of race. That's for sure. So I don't know exactly what happened, although he makes mention occasionally to CBS and Grace Johnson, I believe, at ABC. Mm-hmm. He talks about her from time to time, but just briefly and not very so deeply. I'm thinking what we're seeing on NBC is pretty much what we saw on all networks, except for the issue of race. Mm-hmm. It was different on NBC. This guy was way ahead of himself. In terms of racial stereotypes and depictions of race and all races.
And that's the one hot button issue we haven't discussed. So let's get on to that if we can.
Sure.
It's, how did Helfrich treat these stereotypes in what was still an era where segregation was the norm in the South?
Yeah, it really was. And not only blacks, Jews, Catholics occasionally, mm-hmm. Irish.
Because he had to be worried about losing Southern affiliates or making Southern affiliates mad.
Oh, yeah. And boy, you know, you think, well, everybody used to watch Uncle Milty in the South. People hated Uncle Milty. They would sooner watch a Western rerun than watch
Uncle Milty.
Because
he was Jewish.
He was a Jew from New York. What are you talking about? You know, I'm not going to watch that, you know. And so, so there was a lot of, anger and frustration over some of the stuff that was coming out of New York. Remember, New York was the center of television for the first 10 years of its life, really.
So, they could watch a Jew on one channel, and Bishop Sheen, you got the Catholic Church on the other, and the South is going, I'll turn it off.
Right, and look at the type of shows you would have on there. I mean, there was Life with Luigi, about an Italian immigrant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was
Abby's Irish Rose, a Catholic boy in love with a Jewish boy in love with a Catholic girl.
Yeah. And, you know, and Ralph Cramden, the Honeymooners and mm-hmm. stuff. Now, here's a low-class person living in a little dumpy apartment, you know.
Always threatening to beat his wife.
Yeah, always threatening. Yeah, exactly. That's not very savory. You know, it doesn't really reflect well on the American culture.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only until television moved to the West Coast
is
when we started seeing then Leave It to Beaver, Donna Reed, you know, mm-hmm. Ozzie and Harriet. And
but if you were on NBC in the Helfrich era, I mean, could you have Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald singing a duet and it not be a problem? Or, you know, for example, or...
I think it would be a problem.
It would
be a problem, yeah, because I know what happened to Nat King Cole, and it was mm-hmm. it was tough. Nat King Cole started out on NBC with a 15-minute program, and a lot of people think that it was canceled by NBC, but it wasn't canceled by NBC. Nat King Cole had the program. It didn't do very well, did very poorly in the ratings, and it couldn't get sponsorships. So what did Sarnoff do? Sarnoff moved it.
It's David Sarnoff,
the head of the network, said, well, you're not getting good ratings, so I'm going to move you. And he moved the program to the summertime, I believe, and gave him a half hour. And they still couldn't get sponsorship because they said Nat King Cole endorsing any of our products or being on, you know, on his program, our products would be seen as Negro products.
Nat King Cole was a good-looking, handsome man who was who crooned romantic ballads.
Oh, he was great.
And
yeah.
I guess that made some white people feel uncomfortable.
Well, a lot of people said, a lot of people love Nat King Cole. White people, white racists loved Nat King Cole.
As long as he wasn't singing with a white woman or to a white woman.
Or eating in a restaurant near them. But they loved how he sang. Mm-hmm. You know, but segregation forever. Segregation forever, but hooray for Nat King Cole. You know, really, that's the way the attitude was. So it was because of not being able to get sponsorship that eventually Nat King Cole said, look, we fought the good fight for a year and a half. Nobody wants to sponsor this program, no matter what they did. They couldn't even cobble together local things.
Yeah.
I'm out. So it was Nat King Cole that pulled the plug on the show. But it was a great show, and it really did a lot of things. And there were some big stars on it, too. I mean, because people like Nat Cole.
Yes.
The Ella Fitzgerald and the Sinatras and Tony Bennett's and stuff, they were on the show.
And a young Billy Preston when he was only 13 years
old.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. So anyway, the thing about Helfrich was he was very sensitive to these issues, the black and white issue in particular. And there was a fellow by the name of Eddie Cantor. People might remember that name, not our young people.
He was a contemporary of Al Jolson.
Yeah, so by the time he hit television, and he was a pretty big star on television in the 1950s, 50, 51, 52, right in there, he was in his 60s. He was in his mid-60s. And I remember Eddie Cantor was the guy that started the March of Dimes. I mean, he's a huge philanthropist and loved people and what have you, and against racism. He really was. He wouldn't even go into restaurants that refused to serve black people. He wouldn't, because some of his best friends were black and what have you. Mm-hmm. But Eddie Cantor, just like Al Jolson, would put on that black shoe polish on his face and make his lips real big and put on a nappy wig and funny glasses and dance around singing, "Toot, toot, tootsie, don't cry," you know, and do all that kind of stuff on television. And Stockton Helfrich was puzzled by this. Why would this man, who is so kind and so generous to so many people, want to do this, want to black up and become a minstrel in 1950 television?
Because it was mocking and ridiculing the entire race, that kind of activity.
But they didn't see it that way.
Yeah.
Really?
No.
Cantor and Al Jolson didn't see it. They saw it as grand traditional entertainment, you know, where we black up and bounce around singing goofy like that. Well, that couldn't be cottoned to. Actually, maybe that's not the right word. But that couldn't be. Didn't accept that. Tolerate, right. He didn't. Stockton said that this has to stop. And so that was, you know, like two bull goats on this one. And Cantor said, no, I can't stop. That's my act. That's what I do, you know, among the other things I do. And it was not only him, but if you look at some of the movies from the 1940s and 50s, I mean, Judy Garland.
Fred Astaire did a tribute in a movie to build Bojangles Robinson, and Astaire really did admire Robinson's mastery of the dance, but Astaire blacked his face in what he meant to be a heartfelt tribute to him, and he did not see the dichotomy.
No. And I think that's the power of hegemony. That's the power of ideologic hegemony, and that's what we're talking about here, where ideology, the great power of ideology and the great power of hegemony, too, is its invisibleness. Mm-hmm. You know, there is no, we're like fish in water. You know, we can't see the water. Fish can't see the water. We can't see the ideology that surrounds us. And that was what was happening. But we were starting to change now. Remember, this is way before Brown v. Board of Education. We're still during, you know, times of, Supreme Court arguments that remained
Plessy v. Ferguson,
the Plessy v. Ferguson thing, and the Jim Crow laws that were around as well. So it was Helfrich then that said, "We got to stop this blackface stuff. It's out." And that's when Eddie Cantor quit the Colgate Hall of Fame or whatever it was
Colgate
called.
Colgate Comedy
Hall.
Hour.
I think it was the Colgate Music Hall or something like, or maybe it was the Kraft Music Hall.
And it took guts to say no to that big a star
because
huge star.
Yeah, and across the board, he didn't like Amos and Andy. Helfrich didn't like Amos and Andy. Didn't like. We talked about this.
Beulah.
Yeah, Beulah, right. He didn't like, which was on ABC, and refused to take it when he had a chance to purchase Beulah after a run on ABC. He could have purchased it for the NBC local NBC's network or station. He wouldn't do it. He said no. We're past all that now. Yeah. We're just past all that. So
this is
way ahead.
This is a fascinating story of a fascinating man. If you care about early TV or the nature of censorship and how society decides, or how society's gatekeepers decides what is acceptable and what's not acceptable in a mass medium, then read America's First Network TV Censor, the work of NBC Stockton Helfrich by Dr. Bob Pondillo.
Thank you. By the way, you can find it on Amazon. If you just go there and search Pondillo, it'll be there.
Amazon.com. And it's was published by Southern Illinois University Press.
Yes.
Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Jenna. Pleasure.
This is MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. You can join us again at the same time next Sunday. Please do. In the meantime, check out the podcast at your leisure at MTSUnews.com. And we're available on iTunes.